Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks and the Learning College. We're here to learn. Find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com, also at alexlender.com. In time. Today we're going to complete the section of the Leo Frank book from Nation of Islam, Answers to Unanswered Questions about various and sundry pertaining to the Leo Frank affair. That is, the crime, the conviction, the campaign on behalf of his defenders, and just the general 100-year history attempt to use a fake story to boost Jewish lie narratives in the U.S. Anyway, we're going to do about 3:30 up to the end of this particular section is at 3:61, so about the same as the last one. We split this in two. So let's dig into it again. This is Volume 3 of The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews. That's a series published by the Nation of Islam. The first two concern Jewish domination of the slave trade and Jewish domination of the agricultural products markets produced by the slaves in America. And then the third one was the kind of the turning point in black-Jew relations in the U.S., the Leo Frank case, the lynching of a guilty man. And that came out in 2016 from the researchers around Chicago, where a Nation of Islam is located. So we pick up on page 330. We resume. A Jewish exodus from Georgia? An important embellishment of the Leo Frank saga is that Jews fled Georgia in large numbers after his August 17, 1915 lynching. A hasty Jewish exodus would certainly seem logical after an anti-Jewish pogrom of the massive proportions so widely claimed. Journalist Howard Simon's take on the aftermath of Frank's demise was typical of the dire accounts. Quote, Frank's brutal death spooked the Jews of Georgia and far beyond. Many families fled Atlanta, some never to return. Others sent their children away. All were afraid that they, too, would be felled by the same recurring hate virus. So anyone opposed to having their kid raped, strangled, killed by a Jew is carrying the virus of hate. Notice Jews act as one. They acted as one in defending Leo Frank, and now they're fleeing because they're not making any distinction between themselves any more than they make distinctions between the people they hate, which is all the other nations they call goyim, or cattle. Daniel J. Borsten, a relative of one of Frank's lawyers, said, quote, There followed in Atlanta one of the worst pogroms ever known in an American city, an unpleasant reminder of the Russia from which they had fled. Simply a lie. The website history.com attaches a number to the alleged phenomenon, stating as a matter of fact, thousands of Jewish residents in Atlanta were, in italics, forced to flee the city because police refused to stop the lynch mob. A cataclysmic event, given that the Jewish population of Atlanta at this time was estimated to be about 7,000. Eli N. Evans, writer of The Provincials, spoke of the grisly lynching of Leo Frank, which, he said, put a pall on Jewish life, inducing half the Jewish population to leave Atlanta. Fear, he asserted, spread throughout the South. Had such a mass flight occurred, it would have been the second mass Jewish exodus from Georgia, the first being in 1740. The English colonial rulers had banned slavery from the colony, a ban that triggered an exodus of both Christians and Jews, until only three Jewish families were left in Georgia. The Jews left the colony, according to Rabbi Dr. Jacob Rader Marcus, because, quote, Negro slavery was prohibited. The liquor traffic was forbidden. That's more or less why they left Russia, too, because they had a monopoly essentially over liquor, essentially or legally over liquor sales, and it was ended, and so their profit possibilities weren't as great. And apparently it was somewhat similar in Georgia. Liquor traffic was forbidden, and so was Negro slavery. So the Jews are like, we're out of here. If you can't make money off vices, you can't make money. More or less the Jewish attitude. Jewish winemaker Abraham DeLion said he left for, quote, the want of Negroes, whereas his white servants cost him more than he was able to afford. It was not until 1749 that Georgia permitted slavery, and that is when Jews returned en masse to stay. By 1771, half of Georgia's 30,000 population were black slaves. And while that slave-based Jewish exodus from colonial Georgia has been well documented, the Leo Frank-based exodus may be as unprovable as the conjured cries of "Hang the Jew." As can be gleaned from the many reports, notices, ads, and articles in the daily press, Frank's April 1913 arrest and August 1913 conviction for the murder of the Gentile Mary Fagan caused no distraction in the social, religious, or business life of the Jewish community, and no disruption of their relationships with their Gentile neighbors and customers. They keep running the papers, which they dominate editorially if they don't own them outright. They're running all the ads from the Jewish merchants. They're doing business as usual. And they lie about it and say there's a pogrom that drove most of the community out. So just, you notice, time after time, wherever they can, Jews are lying, always to make the other guy look like the bad guy and themselves the innocent victim. A few months after Frank's trial and conviction, Jewish merchant M. Rich heralded his company's 1913 Christmas sales, which would necessarily involve Christian Gentile customers, saying the volume, quote, was more than satisfactory, unquote. Essig Brothers reported that, quote, business was great. And Jacob's Pharmacy said extra employees were needed to handle the holiday rush. One might expect the many Jewish businesses in Georgia to face collapse and ruin in the aftermath of the Frank trial. The front page of the January 4, 1914 issue of the Atlanta Journal reports that the Marcus Loeb Company built a brand new 42,000 square foot building for its manufacturing operations and its, quote, 300 operators. That same issue reported that the Hirsch brothers had joined forces to combine their grocery and tobacco businesses. Louis Hirsch claimed that 1913 generated the, quote, largest sales of any year in his 14-year career. He expected 1914 to be unusually successful, direct quote, in Atlanta. Next to that story was a photograph of the entire sales force of the Rosenfeld Company with all their names listed underneath. They had just enjoyed, quote, one of the jolliest affairs ever held at Atlanta's Standard Club, the foremost Jewish social club in the South. Atlanta's Standard Club. The dinner, quote, was in celebration of the close of a successful year, 1913, for the company, which supplied home furnishings goods throughout the South, like a Lowe's or Home Depot or a Marantz or something like that. The newspapers reported on the burial of J.W. Hirschfeld, which was attended by his brethren of the Free Sons of Israel and Frank's own clergyman, Rabbi David Marks, just 6 months after the guilty verdict. So Jews are doing just fine, even as their propagandists of their tribe write that they're having to flee for pogroms that didn't exist. The Journal announced that a large audience had heard a lecture on, quote, Judaism within and without, delivered by, quote, the unusually gifted Dr. H. Yood, Y-O-O-D. Noted cartoonist and humorist Rube Goldberg actually came into Atlanta for an appearance, and the Journal headline of January 5, 1914 announced, quote, Goldberg ready to uncork barrels of fun. He's the guy who drew the ridiculous setups to produce an result that could be very easily produced a simple way. That's a Rube Goldberg device. You'll see it described as. Don't see it referred to much anymore, but it used to be fairly commonly referred to. Goldberg's cartoons were featured prominently in nearly every issue of that paper, and often on the front page, sometimes on the very same pages covering news of the Leo Frank affairs. When Goldberg arrived, the paper reported, the sun shone a little brighter and, quote, the Negro porter's face was cracked 2 feet wide where his mouth should have been. He, Goldberg, will also be wined and dined by the newspaper fraternity and given the glad hand everywhere, for if there is one fellow genuinely and universally popular, it is Rube, and we want him to know it. In none of these cases was there any mention of anti-Jewish sentiment or trepidation about, quote, anti-Semitism among the Jews themselves. Apparently no Jews had fled, were fleeing, or were planning to flee from Atlanta. Miss Marion Goldsmith hosted a, quote, beautiful spring luncheon with cakes, flowers, and fruit baskets at her Peachtree Street home. She wore a beautiful morning toilet costume, a blue taffeta, and Malene, not your standard refugee attire. M-A-L-I-N-E. I don't know if that's Maline or Malene. Never heard of it. But if crinoline is something, then maybe it's Mulline. To top it off, in March of 1914, less than a year after the murder of Mary Fagan, and while their leader Leo Frank sat in prison cell on death row, the Grand Lodge of B'nai B'rith held its 40th convention, attracting to Atlanta 70 of the most prominent Hebrews, that's a direct quote, and their friends and families from all over the South. In his well-received address, Mayor Woodward expressed his friendship to the Jews and pledged to assist the order in any way possible, according to the Atlanta Journal report. So the 1913 trial and conviction of Frank produced no exodus. But the case dragged on for two more years, culminating in the lynching of Leo Frank on August 17, 1915. And here again, little evidence supports the shocking tales of Jewish trauma and suffering, again prefiguring the imaginary Holocaust. They just make up lies. Quite the contrary, the pro-Frank Atlanta Journal reported in its August 29th edition that the Marietta police actually added 15 officers to its ranks after the lynching because officials had received letters from supporters of Leo Frank threatening various sorts of vengeance because Frank was lynched. Eight, quote, suspicious men thought to be associated with those threats were rounded up and invited to leave, direct quote, the city limits by police. The report did not disclose the men's religious affiliation. The only Frank-related violence appears to be the episode when a Jewish store owner named Joseph Sokolow struck and wounded a man named James Lee, who had shown a photo of Frank's lynched body in the store. If any Jewish family or enterprise should have faced the wrath of a bloodthirsty anti-Semitic mob, it was the Montags, who owned the National Pencil Company where the murder of Mary Fagan occurred. They were seen as having countenanced an unsafe environment where teenage Gentile girls were in constant sexual peril from their employer, whom the Montags had installed and seemed to be protecting at all costs. But this item nevertheless appeared in the Atlanta Journal just 33 days after Frank's lynching. The firm, Montag Brothers, reports that its mail orders are still coming in large quantities and that indications are that people of the country are needing goods and needing them at once. That's a block quote. All the Atlanta dailies were filled with advertisements from Jewish-owned businesses without fail or interruption. None of them chose to use their paid space in the newspapers to make any statement at all about the, quote, injustice they faced as Jews or to simply withdraw their ads or close their accounts in protest. So again, they just simply lie about everything. They lie that the verdict was achieved by intimidation and people screaming against Jews in the street and in the courtroom. Lie. And they lie that there were pogroms against Jews afterward that caused half of them to flee. They just lie about everything. Atlanta Journal's post-lynching view of Jewish life. Next little section. Atlanta Journal's post-lynching view of Jewish life. In the weeks and months following the August 17th lynching of Leo Frank, the social and business pages of the Atlanta Journal newspaper show a Jewish community at ease and involved in Georgia's social life and community affairs. August 1915, this is the month of the lynching, the week after Frank's murder, the Goldsteins announced the December wedding of their daughter, Bess, to Ralph Lippman to be held in Atlanta. The United Hebrew School invited the public to a musical program held at the Jewish Educational Alliance building, which was to be addressed by, quote, the rabbis of the various synagogues of the city. This notice was positioned next to a large ad for Jacob's Pharmacy. September 1915, a month after the lynching, Will and Mac Hirschberg returned to Atlanta. They didn't flee, they returned to Atlanta from a successful sales trip through North Carolina. An article on the same page that matter-of-factly reported a Tennessee lynching of a black man trumpeted the fact that Albert Greenberg, the most popularly known prescriptionist in the state of Georgia, would be joining the staff at Jacob's Pharmacy, where he would no doubt, quote, make a friend of every man he meets. The paper reported that the H.L. Singer Company had increased its delivery facilities to handle increased orders. J.M. Frankel, the swell social leader of the Rosenfeld Company, had just returned from California. According to the journal, quote, he declares he had the best time of his life and saw marvelous things. Mr. L.R. Lebsky came back to Atlanta, didn't flee, came back to Atlanta and to his job at Rosenfeld after a pleasant vacation of fishing and swimming. The Atlanta Zionist Society announced that its musical program would be held at the Jewish Educational Alliance. Harry Edison announced that he would open a new cut-rate shoe store. The journal informed Atlanta that all the synagogues in the city were preparing for Rosh Hashanah, and it listed the other Jewish holidays that would soon be celebrated in Atlanta. On September 7th, the paper reported that Joe Jacobs came to Athens and gave a banquet for his boyhood friends. The Jews announced that their sermons for the Jewish New Year would be a call for peace in the world and a fundraiser for their brethren overseas. Jews in prison were excused from labor on the Jewish holiday and pastored to by Leo Frank's own rabbi, David Marks, the one who tried to, along with Mrs. Frank's wife, get the black food vendor outside the jail to change her story. Tried to get her to lie. That's his own rabbi. They are a race of liars. The local Atlanta election, it was found, fell on a Jewish holiday, and so an effort was made to change the Atlanta law, not the Jewish law, the Atlanta law, to enable Jews to vote. And Jews were respectfully asked by the fire commissioner to be careful with their use of candles during the holiday celebrations. Hundreds of employees of Rich's Department Store, the largest Jewish business in Atlanta, were pictured in the September 19 issue of the Atlanta Journal. Also, the Atlanta Zionist organization held its third annual Sukkoth dance. Maybe it's Sukkoth, S-U-C-C-O-T-H. That was September, then October 1915. A.W. Rosenfeld reported a positive business outlook and planned to double the size of one of his window shade making divisions. The paper reported that Sime Einstein left with his son for New York, but it was only to buy goods for a new store that they intended to open in Atlanta, not to flee. Cotton magnate Oscar Elsass felt comfortable enough with Atlanta's court system that he used it to file a lawsuit against another Jew, Nathan Wolfe, for $2,000 in damages for an auto accident he said was Mrs. Wolfe's fault. Jacob's Pharmacy, the Jewish business that Leo Frank said he visited on the day of the murder, reported that it was setting sales records for the drug Tanlac, T-A-N-L-A-C, at its 11 Atlanta stores. Jacob's Pharmacy has 11 Atlanta stores. The paper noted that Rabbi Hyman Solomon of the Washington Street Synagogue will deliver an interesting sermon on the subject, Why Some People Commit Treason. November 1915, the journal reported that E.M. Hirschberg was reappointed for the fourth time to be the editor of the Macon County Citizen newspaper. Riches hired a, quote, corset expert from Chicago to help Southern women obtain the proper fit. Frank's employer, Montag Brothers, appears again in an ad to offer to entertain a large number of merchants that were arriving in Atlanta. Later in the month, the Montag representative cautioned buyers to get their holiday orders in soon, as business was brisk. Readers were informed that two of Montag's salespeople, S.F. and Leopold Hine, had spent Thanksgiving at the Atlanta home of their parents. Leonard Jacobus was likewise brought back home in Atlanta from southern Georgia, having brought back to his employer, F.W. King and Company, quote, glowing reports of great prosperity prevailing in that section. Congratulations were expressed for the splendid work of the local leader of the Atlanta chapter of the Associated Advertising Club, Frank E. Lowenstein, after achieving a national position. That article is directly below a report of the first meeting of 15 members of the reborn Ku Klux Klan atop Stone Mountain, a meeting where, significantly, neither Leo Frank, Mary Fagan, nor the Knights of Mary Fagan are mentioned. December 1915. The Jewish Progressive Club elected its new leaders, who were anxious to move into their brand new $30,000 building. That would be a $730,000 in today's money. This announcement is on the same page as an advertisement for the Jewish-funded Ku Klux Klan recruitment movie, The Birth of a Nation. All these examples demonstrate that the reports of anti-Jewish violence and rioting are unsupported by the extent reported in and around Atlanta, Georgia. By the extant reportage. So the media for 6 months after is showing that there was absolutely nothing but business as usual among Jews in Atlanta. The workaday business of proving that Jews lie about everything they say is being documented by blacks, just as it's been documented by whites, white nationalists. All these examples, again, demonstrate that the reports of anti-Jewish violence and rioting are unsupported by the extant reportage in and around Atlanta, Georgia. The Daily Show that not only did Jews seem to have comfortably maintained good relations with the Gentiles, but also Jewish businesses continue their advertising accounts with the papers without interruption. In the end, no Jews were forced to leave the city, the state, or the South as a reaction to the Frank case. In fact, a Jewish leader named Victor Kriegshaber, who was a member of the grand jury that indicted Leo Frank, was elected president of the Atlanta Chamber of Commerce just 5 months after Frank's lynching. The New York Times, the primary promoter of the anti-Semitism myth, cited Kriegshaber's election as conclusive proof that Atlantans felt no antagonism toward Jews. Under the headline, "Prejudice Well Disproved," the Times wrote, quote, "All can now point to a fact showing conclusively that the bitter rage of which Frank was the unfortunate victim, was not the result of his race, but of the peculiar conditions which existed in Atlanta prior to the murder of Mary Fagan, and other conditions which arose during the trial of Frank." Dr. Albert Lindemann concluded that far from Jewish panic and mass exodus, quote, "Jews continued to move into the city in numbers no less impressive than before the Frank affair." Once again, Harry Golden appears to be the source for the unsubstantiated claims of a mass exodus and anti-Jewish boycotts, but Stephen Hertzberg corrects him, asserting that, quote, "there was no dramatic exodus or panic." A study by the Goldring/Woldenberg Institute of Southern Jewish Life found that, quote, "Despite the fears stemming from the Frank lynching, Atlanta's Jewish community continued to grow from 4,000 Jews in 1910 to 12,000 by 1937. That is, there was a net population gain of 300 Jews per year in Atlanta, not a decline. Frank's wife, Lucille, buried her husband in Brooklyn and then returned to Atlanta. In the spring of 1916, she left for Memphis, Tennessee to take a position as manager of her brother-in-law's clothing shop. She returned to Atlanta in 1921, quote, where she took a job at one of the city's best fashion salons. Her, quote, Negro driver chauffeured her to her bridge games and other appointments." So even his wife's getting along just fine there. So just another example of Jews lying to close out that section. And then we have sort of a montage of clips from newspapers. About five pages of those, and then we'll read some of this. "Did Jews run for their lives? One of the myths about the Frank case is that anti-Semitic violence forced Jews to flee the state of Georgia. Below are several pages of articles from the Atlanta Daily newspapers from the time of Frank's arrest on April 29, 1913, until several months after his lynching on August 17, 1915, which show no signs that Jewish life was in any way disturbed." I'll just read the headlines. It's basically they're just proving all the stuff they cited. "After tour of West, no place suits him like Atlanta." So it's some Jew businessman. "Jewish Alliance honors shown in Kriegshaber. Rabbi J.M. Levine formally installed. Leading Hebrews are coming to convention. Welcome given to B'nai B'rith. New Jewish Club officers are named. City election falls on Jewish holiday. We'll honor Hyman at meeting tonight at Atlanta Hall, at Alliance Hall. Hebrew school will give program today. $11,000 is subscribed for finishing touches to Progressive Club. Day of Atonement to be observed by Jews. That's in October 1915. September, Sime Einstein off for New York. Montag's holiday trade going at lively clip. Entertainment at Jewish Alliance. Day of the Atonement to be observed today. Sukkoth dance. Admin will hold prosperity meeting. This is all September and some October. Dr. Joe Jacobs gives a banquet at Athens. Jews asked to exercise care in burning candles. Exercises at Alliance. Hebrews are planning for Rosh Hashanah. New shoe store opening in Atlanta. Mr. Albert Greenberg, now with Jacobs Store. Rabbi Solomon to preach Friday night. 1,500 Jews unable to vote in September 30th in city primary. Rosenfeld Company to double shade factory capacity. Jews to plan aid for brothers. Wedding announcement. Sampler items. Hirschberg Company has best 15 days in its history. Krigshaber to head Chamber of Commerce. Jewish Progressive Club names officers. Picture of Krigshaber. Again, November, December. All records smashed, says big drug firm. Hirschberg again is editor of The Citizen. Kantz will speak at Jewish Alliance. Jewish farmers prepare to care for immigrants. Atlanta Section Council of Jewish Women reports splendid work for a year. And last page. Hebrews are planning for Rosh Hashanah. New shoe store opening in Atlanta. Mr. Albert Greenberg now with Jacob's Store. 1,500 Jews unable to vote September 30th in city primary. Hebrew school give program today. I'm not sure why some of these are repeated. Maybe the same thing in different papers, but you get the idea. That's enough of that. And business as usual. That's what you want to take away. Jews claim they were so scared and they were threatened with violence and they had to flee the pogroms after the Frank lynching. Or irregular execution, as Tom Watson called it. But in fact, it was business as usual. In fact, things were going so well that Jews were continuing to move into the city. Businesses were continuing to expand. News section, we're on 345 now. The Black Side of Georgia Justice. Justice in ironic quotes. When it came to justice in Georgia, blacks experienced an outcome markedly different from that which Jews enjoyed. As with other states with the high populations of blacks, Georgia's legal system remained critical to the state's white supremacist infrastructure, and it wholly devoted its resources to crippling the black man and woman and forcing them, through fear, intimidation, and unprovoked brutality, into economic and political subservience. Candidates in the 1906 gubernatorial race publicly jousted for votes over the most effective way to keep blacks away from the ballot box. Direct quote. The overarching policy imperative was to keep the state's 250,000 black farm workers and their families tethered to the plantation, providing the labor for an economy still almost totally based on cotton. All of Georgia's laws upheld and reinforced that racist economic policy objective. Blacks could be arrested without cause, put on chain gangs, and held for any length of time. The concept of legal representation by an attorney or even due process was as remote for blacks as was voting or equal pay. The hardened custom of barring Negro testimony placed all blacks in a legal no-man's land where a crime against them was entirely invisible unless and until a white man, for his own purposes and self-interest, chose to corroborate that testimony. There were fewer than 10 black lawyers practicing in the entire state of Georgia at the time of the Leo Frank trial, down from twice that number just a few years before. As far as blacks were concerned, the Atlanta police force was little more than a legitimized den of hoodless Klansmen. The black-owned newspaper Weekly Defiance in 1881 says, quote, "We have lived in Atlanta 27 years, and we have heard the lash sounding from the cabins of the slaves poured on by their masters, but we have never seen a meaner set of low-down cutthroats, scrapes, and murderers than the city of Atlanta has to protect the peace." In 1905, Atlanta police arrested roughly 10,000 black men, an astounding 20% of the black male population, but not for any actual crimes. Through the generalized charge of vagrancy, quote-unquote, black, quote, criminals underwent corrections through the therapy of forced labor. Black men were leased to planters in times of harvest and to construction firms to build the state's roads and bridges. 9 out of 10 people arrested in Georgia for these invented offenses were black, branding much of the male population as, quote, criminal, a fact that would frame much of the pro-Frank rhetoric at the trial and in the media then and since. Professor Leonard Dinnerstein confirmed that Atlanta's police force, quote, rely increasingly on an irrational use of power. On one occasion, for example, when Atlanta had experienced a labor shortage, the police attempted to rectify the condition by arresting all able-bodied men found on one of the main streets. Employed and unemployed, black and white, were hauled into court, fined, and sentenced to the stockade without being given a chance to defend themselves. Remember what I mentioned about Mencken writing about them doing stuff in Baltimore similar to that? Whenever they needed something repainted or they electric or plumbing, they would simply arrest people on some spurious charge and force them to do the work for free. And then we've got some headlines on the next page, 347. Throughout the Leo Frank case, blacks were suffering horrific public violence. This is just a sample from the Atlanta Constitution in August 1915. Negroes were hanged as spectators sang. There is a subtitle, "There is a Land of Pure Delight." 7 men legally executed and 2 lynched. Below that, 4 men hanged in Alabama. 2 Negroes lynched for attacking girls. May 1915, slick Negro not fined for stockade escape. Would-be lynchers balked by sheriff. 3 men are shot by Negro from ambush. Worth County farmer dead, 2 others fatally wounded. 2 men are held for killing of Negro. Woman's assailant lynched in Decatur. After being identified by victim, Negro is shot to death by mob at Amsterdam. That's how whites used to react to black crime. And I'll actually read that story, so a few paragraphs, and just see how things were different 100 years ago. Bainbridge, Georgia. This is about the lynching in Decatur. Searching parties early tonight captured a Negro who yesterday criminally assaulted a white woman at Amsterdam and, after carrying him before his victim, who identified him, quickly killed him with about 100 shots. The Negro's name is John Riggins. He was about 23 years old and had been in the community only a few days. Riggins made no attempt to escape but returned to his work this morning in the tobacco packing house. When some of the searching party approached him and inquired if he knew a certain Negro from Quincy, Riggins became nervous and soon left work. He was caught before he had gone 200 feet and carried before the victim for identification. She promptly identified him after she had saved the lives of others earlier in the day through failure to accuse them. Feeling again normal. The rest of the program was quickly enacted and feeling in the section has returned to its normal state. Decatur has been a county for nearly 100 years, but so far, as is known, the first criminal assault in its history occurred yesterday afternoon when an unknown Negro attacked the wife of a prominent tobacco man in the lower section of the county. The woman started out from her home near Amsterdam to the tobacco packing house where her husband was working. While passing through a thickly wooded section, the Negro sprang into the buggy and wrested from her hands the pistol with which she attempted to defend herself. When she recovered consciousness, the Negro was gone, and on the back of her head was a painful wound. Whether inflicted by the butt of the pistol or by her head striking the buggy tire, she did not know. She managed to reach the place where her husband was awaiting her and told her story. And then something, I can't read it, was orderly. Posse was orderly, maybe? Yeah. Sheriff's deputies went to the scene immediately and started a thorough search, but an all-night effort failed to locate the Negro. The sheriff of Gadsden County, Florida, just across the line, also had a posse on the lookout, and besides, there were hundreds of the citizens of that community in the woods searching for the fugitive. And this is an assault, not even a rape. From information obtained at the sheriff's office, it seems that the crowd in pursuit was unusually orderly and that there was no evidence of drunkenness nor any tendency to molest innocent Negroes. The people of the lower section of the county constitute some of the most conservative and level-headed people in this part of the state. The Negro's victim has been intermittently unconscious during the day and is reported to have fainted several times. Although her health was none too good at the time, she is reported to be resting very well at a late hour this afternoon. And that's how it used to be in America. Back to the main text. The power wielded by the police, however, was not irrational, as Dinnerstein suggests. The need for black labor was particularly great, and the police force served as an important arm of a specific labor conscription strategy of Atlanta's business and political leaders. With all this flurry of police activity on behalf of business interests, it's no wonder only one murder in 100 was ever punished in Georgia. And since 1911, 20 unsolved murders of black women in Atlanta further proved the police force's real function as labor recruiters and overseers, not as peace officers and crime fighters. And we've got next section, black trial, white trial. Couple epigraphs. First from Abraham Foxman, former head of the ADL. We believe that there should be consequences to bigots and bigotry. One way to combat bigots is to put a price on bigotry. I would hope that, if this is, in fact, true, that his colleagues condemn him and distance themselves from him. That's Abraham Foxman, former national director of the Anti-Defamation League. And again, there must have been a nigger in the crime who knew about it before Newtley, the night watchman, or anyone else. Newtley was the one who discovered the body, of course. I'm afraid Newt knew. Yet, if he did, he is one of the most remarkable niggers I ever saw, and I wish I had his nerve. From the closing argument by Leo Frank's attorney, Luther Rosser. There was a galactic difference between the extensive hearing Leo Frank obtained and the kind of, quote, justice routinely dispensed to black defendants. Leo Frank's trial was the most expensive, $10,000, about $1.3 million in today's money, and longest trial, 30 days in a transcript of over 1 million words, in the history of the South. So the most expensive and longest trial in the history of the South for Leo Frank. By the time the governor commuted his death sentence, Frank had filed appeals in a dozen courts, had the services of two of the largest private investigation firms in the country, and obtained the representation of more than a dozen lawyers, including the governor himself. Compare that with this account by journalist Pierre Van Paasen, P-A-A-S-S-E-N, who visited an Atlanta courtroom 10 years after the Leo Frank lynching. Quote, little story here for about a page. The judge, a shriveled-up little man with blackened teeth stumps and a drooping mustache, wore a soiled linen jacket and had unfastened his collar, for it was stifling hot in the courtroom. On the side stood the prisoners, closely packed together, all Negroes. They were waiting to be tried, or rather to be sentenced, and were called one by one to face the man on the bench. "Joe Smith!" called out a cop. The man answering to that name approached the magistrate. "Nigger, what was you doing in that woman's room Saturday night?" "Judge, I wasn't in no woman's room." 30 days. "Next!" "Fred Hastings!" called out another cop. "Haven't I seen you here before, nigger?" "No, sir, Judge, I never." 30 days. "Next!" Elsie Gibbon. "Your name? Your name, Elsie? You scratched your landlady's face. Was you drunk, Elsie?" "No, sir, Your Honor, I wasn't drunk." 30 days. "Charles Newman." "Nigger, you were caught with a knife in your hand, threatening an officer." "Your Honor, that wasn't no knife." "You carried a deadly weapon. 30 days in the chain gang." "But, Your Honor, I was peeling potatoes when the officer walked in. It wasn't no knife." "Don't talk back. 60 days. 60 days, Your Honor? What for?" "Shut up, nigger. 90 days in the chain gang. The trouble with you is that you talk too much." "Geez, Your Honor, it was the Victrola that was playing. I wasn't doing no talking." "You talked yourself into a year in the chain gang, nigger. You used profane language in court. Take that blabbermouth away. Next." So they're pretty much batch processing these niggers. It's not just, but it is kind of funny. In just 200 words, five of them nigger, and about 5 minutes, the four blacks were sentenced to a total of 455 days, their lives and the lives of their families unalterably redefined and irrevocably labeled criminal, in the very same way as was James Connolly. Now, white nationalist or not, you can see his point. They're kind of getting screwed. In open court, Frank's attorney, Luther Rosser, spoke the common language of white superiority. Quote, "Nobody knows better than these police how they lie. Take a Negro caught with stolen chickens. He always says he bought them from Aunt Lizzie Jones. It's gotten so now that Andy Calhoun sends them to the chain gang just the minute they say that. Tell me they have an imagination. I had old Negro mammies tell me about Br'er Rabbit and Tar Babies long before I ever heard of Uncle Remus." This was the justice faced daily in Atlanta by black men, women, and children, a system devoid of the flock of attorneys, private investigators, multiple appeals, cross-examinations, international letter campaigns, petition drives, and indignant editorials, let alone a stenographer or witnesses or even a swearing-in that Leo Frank availed himself of but claimed he never received. Next section, Georgia lynchings after Leo Frank. NAACP Field Secretary James Weldon Johnson wrote just 5 months after Frank's lynching, quote, "Only a few weeks ago, Georgia published a declaration of superiority by lynching 7 Negroes and burning down the meeting places of several colored lodges. Now comes the news of a mob in the same state hanging 5 Negroes." That was 5 months after Leo Frank. In Valdosta, Georgia, just 3 years after Frank's death, a pregnant black woman named Mary Turner was hanged from a tree, then soaked with gasoline and set afire. As she hung there, a white man ripped open her womb with a penknife. The infant fell out and wailed twice before the monster stomped it to death. These are the forgotten lynch victims of Georgia for whom no books are written. Indeed, they are so forgotten that a 2015 report by the Equal Justice Initiative found an incredible 700 lynchings that had been previously unknown. So they used to claim like 3,000 lynchings over 80 years. Now they claim like 4,000, I think is what that means. Below are just some of the innocent black lynching victims of white America in the state of Georgia since the murder of Leo Frank. And we got basically 3 pages of, let's just read through it and see. Lynching date, victim, Georgia town or county, unsupported accusation. So 12/20, December 20, 1915, Sam Bland and Willie Stewart, the victims, in Dodge County, unsupported accusation, murder. 12/30, so 10 days later, Grandison Goolsby, Mike Goolsby, Ulysses Goolsby, Hosh Jewell, Charles Holmes, James Burton, Early Hightower, in Early County, for murder. And they got 7 of them, and then 5 of them, John Seymour, on 1/20, January 20, 1916, John Seymour, Felix Lake, Frank Lake, Dewey Lake, Major Lake, in Lee County, murder accomplice. They were lynched. Then 2/12, just 1, Marvin Harris in Twiggs County for murder. 2/25, Jesse Harris in Bardo County for attempted theft. Lewis, that's his only name, in Lowndes County for attempted theft. 9/20, Elijah Sturgis in Randolph for unknown offense. 9/20/16, Henry White in Walker County for miscegenation. 9/20, Pete Hudson, Randolph County for murder. 9/27, Moxie Schuler, Decatur for attempted rape. 10/4, Mary Connolly, Calhoun, unknown. 3/1/17, Linton Clinton, Thomas County, scared white girl. 3/28, Joe Nowling in Mitchell County, unknown offense. 9/18, so 6 months without anything, Rufus Moncrief in Clark County, gambling dispute. 11/9/17, Jesse Slater, Brooks County, writing letters to white girl. 11/17, Mac Johnson and Collins Johnson in Mitchell County for argument. 12/15, Claxton Deckel in Candler County for murder. And sometime in 1918, an unknown was lynched in Gordon County for an unknown. Bud Cosby in February 1918 in Fayette County for kidnapping and theft. Then in May 1918, Will Head, Will Thompson, Hayes Turner, Chime Riley, Mary Turner, Eugene Rice, Simon Schumann, three unidentified men, sounds like there might be a couple whites in there, were all lynched on May 17th, 1918 in Brooks County, that's Valdosta, the city, for murder slash accomplice. And the rest of them, the next couple years, are all singles. Tom Devert, unknown, attempted rape. Jim Cobb in Crisp County for murder. Spencer Evans for rape. John Calhoun for murder. Ike Harden for attempted rape. John Gillum for attempted rape. Sandy Reeves, scared white girl. William Little, unknown. Willie Williams, Andrew Ruffin, and Joe Ruffin at the same time for murder slash accomplice. Benny Richards for murder assault. Jim Waters for leaving employer. This is 1919. Charles Kelly for argument. Unknown man for wild talk. Jim Grant for assault. Eli Cooper for organizing black farmers. O.B. Cox for murder. Ernest Glenwood for wild talk. Jack Gordon and Will Brown for murder accomplice. Still in 1919. Mose Martin for murder. Eugene Hamilton for attempted murder. Unknown man for intimacy with white woman. Paul Jones for rape. Wallace Baines for murder. Jack Riddicer for attempted murder. Charles West for murder. And then into 1920, Philip Gaithers in June of 1920 for murder. John Grant for wage dispute. George King, unknown offense. Felix Kremer for aiding criminal. Bob Whitehead, attempted murder. And then three for murder. Will Booney Ivory, Minnie Ivory, and Alex Byrd in Coffee County. Curly McKelvey for murder accomplice. And then 1921, Jim Rowland for attempted murder. Sam Williams, unknown offense. John Lee Eberhardt for murder. Rawls Ross for murder. John Henry Williams for murder. And then three, Aaron Birdsong, Roy Grove, and Wes Hale for aiding criminal. End of 1921. 1922, Will Jones for wild talk. John Glover for murder. Alfred Williams for attempted murder. Charlie Atkins for murder. Will Brid for murder. Joe Jordan and James Harvey for debt dispute. Shake Davis for miscegenation. Will Anderson for attempted rape. Cocky Glover for murder. Jim Reed Long for attempted murder. M.B. Burnett for wild talk. George Butts and Clinton Chamber for murder robbery. That was the first in 1923 in February. And then in August 1923, Aaron Harris, attempted rape. Lee Green, rape. John Haynes, attempted rape. Beach Thrash for murder. Marcus Westmoreland and Penny Westmoreland for argument. End of 1924. 1925, Robert Smith, attempted rape. Willie Dixon, murder. Willie Wilson, unknown offense, 1926. Only two in 1925. So one in 96. Dave Wright, Coffee County, murder, 26. And then nothing for 4 years until 1930. There were seven in 1930. James Irwin for murder. S.S. Mincy for a political dispute. George Grant for murder. William Bryan for unknown offense. Willie Kirkland for attempted rape. Lacey Mitchell for testifying against whites. And Willie Clark for murder in 1930. So that's a list of lynchings after Leo Frank. Next section. Blacks in the Leo Frank case. Several black men and women were in some way involved in the events surrounding the murder of Mary Fagan. Their testimonies were often key to establishing the state's case against Leo Frank, as they often conflicted with some aspect of Frank's alibi. Several more blacks were drawn into the case during the appeals process to overturn Frank's murder conviction. For many, their lives were severely disrupted and permanently altered through their connection to the case. And then we've got a list of the blacks involved in how they were involved. Aaron Allen, a Negro stool pigeon, quote unquote, who early in the investigation of Mary Fagan's murder was employed by the police detectives to stay in the jail cell and coax a confession from Newt Lee, was paid $15 by Frank's agents to swear Conley had confessed to him, Aaron Allen. Gordon Bailey, a nickname Snowball, National Pencil Company elevator operator, arrested April 28th and jailed for at least 3 weeks, friend of James Conley. As a sworn, quote, colored witness for the defendant, he testified at trial. Gordon Bailey, the snowball. Emma Beard, the maid of Frank's assistant, Herbert Schiff. She testified about Schiff's actions on the day of the murder. Bell, just one name, Negro detective employed by William J. Burns. Annie Maud Carter, a jail, quote-unquote, trustee, who was asked by a friend of Frank's to put poison in Conley's food. She declined. Burns hired her to try to frame Conley with a set of forged letters falsely attributed to Conley. She was a serious figure we heard about earlier, Annie Maud Carter. James Jim Conley, the main one they tried to pin it on, the Frank side. Jim Conley, James Jim Conley, a sweeper and former elevator operator at the National Pencil Company, who testified that on the day of the murder, he was ordered by his employer, Leo Frank, to move the dead body of Mary Fagan from the second floor to the basement to write notes to divert suspicion from the murderer, Leo Frank, and to burn the body in the factory furnace. And his testimony got Frank convicted, essentially. Will Green. It was claimed falsely by the defense that Green was shooting craps with Conley in the basement of the factory on the day of the murder, and that he may have been a witness or a participant in the crime. He was said to have left town as a circus employee shortly after the murder. Will Green. Annie Hickson, the maid of Frank's brother-in-law, Charles Ersenbach. She received the call from Frank on the day of the murder, canceling his and Ersenbach's plans to go to a baseball game. She testified that Frank was in the Ersenbach's home the day after the murder, just laughing and talking like they always do. Annie Hickson. Charles A. Isom, I-S-O-M, hired by William J. Burns' agents for $3 a day to find blacks who worked at the factory next door to the National Pencil Company to say that they had heard screams coming from the basement. Ivy Jones testified that Conley was not drunk on the day of the murder, said his affidavit to the contrary was forged. Newt Lee, another, the second biggest figure, the night watchman who actually found the body. National Pencil Company night watchman who discovered the body of Mary Fagan in the factory basement on the last of his hourly rounds. He was implicitly named in the murder notes, and thus he was the first person to be suspected of the crime and the first person the Jews tried to frame for the crime. He was arrested early Sunday morning, April 27th. Truman McCrary, drayman who was at the factory three times on the day of the murder. Albert McKnight, husband of Manola McKnight, revealed to his employers what his wife had told him about Frank's confession to the murder of Mary Fagan. He also disputed Frank's version of what he did and when he came home from lunch on the day of the murder. Manola McKnight, 20-year-old Negro servant girl working in the home of Leo Frank. She told her husband, Albert, and later swore to police that she had overheard Frank's wife say on the night of the murder that an intoxicated and suicidal Leo Frank confessed to killing Mary Fagan. Fred Perkerson, paid by Frank's detective William J. Burns to get a confession from Conley. Arthur Pride, employee of the National Pencil Company who testified about his financial dealings with James Conley. Frank Reese, paid by Frank's detective William J. Burns to get a confession from Conley, seen often with Burns' agent Jimmy Wren. Mary Rich, operated a lunch stand near the factory and was approached by Frank's wife and his spiritual leader, Rabbi Marks, and asked to sign a false affidavit implicating James Conley. She refused, but the false affidavit was forged and submitted anyway. Very significant. Mark Wilson, last one, was said to have seen Conley buy food from Mary Rich, who denied the story as fiction. So those are all the blacks involved in this case. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19 of them. Turning on to 357 or over. Passing over to it. Next section is blacks tortured for Frank's sins. I could shoot you through the bars of your cell right now. A friend of Leo Frank's to James Conley. The mistreatment of blacks who were connected in some way to the case has gone mostly unexamined. After Mary Fagan, whose life was cut short and who endured exploitation and victimization at the hands of her employer, it was the blacks who bore the most abuse in the Leo Frank affair. The many violations of civil and human rights in the two-year-long case were suffered in large part by blacks alone. White witnesses were interviewed, but black witnesses were said to have been sweated or subjected to the third degree, a term defined as the inflicting of pain, physical or mental, to extract confessions or statements. Gordon Bailey was the young black elevator operator in the factory, and he was arrested 2 days after the murder, along with Newt Lee, James Gant, and Arthur Mullinax. He was kept under arrest for at least 3 weeks, and according to one report, was put through a, quote, grueling investigation or interrogation. When the Black Night Watchman was arrested, police handcuffed him to a chair and threatened him with lynching. Dinnerstein wrote, quote, the police allegedly tortured him mercilessly. Indeed, sleep deprivation was one of the methods described by Newt Lee in his testimony. Lindemann added that Lee suffered the common practice for black suspects of being browbeaten and roughed up by the court to extract a confession. Frank himself stated in court that Lee, quote, shrieked and cried upon receiving the third degree, and Frank's own attorney addressed this in the courtroom. Quote, there were things you detectives did to him for which you will never be forgiven. You persecuted the old nigger. But Frank was never treated in this way. In fact, as a suspect held in prison, Frank aided in Lee's interrogation. They put him in the cell, as we heard earlier. Even with this official abuse, it was claimed that Newt Lee actually preferred to remain in the custody of police, in part because he had been harassed by Jewish supporters of Frank and feared for his life. Lee was not released from his ordeal until after Frank's sentencing. James Conley's lawyer, William M. Smith, informed the court that Frank's supporters made extraordinary efforts to force a confession from Conley. Burns agent Annie Maud Carter months later testified that the friends of Leo Frank had tried to poison Conley. Smith told the court that Conley's life was in danger and that he had to be moved from his cell. Quote, Conley had asked to be taken away from the tower to escape the harassments of the visitors of Leo Frank, declaring that they stopped at his cell and tried to make him drink liquor, and had tried to intimidate him by making jeering remarks to him and implying threats. I could shoot you through the bars of your cell right now. And don't you think you ought to be shot? Are some of the statements visitors are quoted as making. Conley's lawyer had to petition the court to permit his client to bathe, but Frank's attorney, Reuben Arnold, protested, quote, I understand they want to give him a bath. If Mr. Smith wants to give him a bath, let him do it. Let him turn the hose on him, if he wants to. Talk of this type about Frank, the accused murderer, would never have been countenanced. Now, there was a footnote I want to read. 901... outlines William M. Smith's charges against Frank's supporters. Smith sees bias. That deponent, Smith, talked with a man who, he is advised, is of Jewish extraction and who deponent believes is doing all he can reasonably to place the blame for this crime on his client, Conley, and who is desirous of seeing the defendant, Frank, cleared. And this man admitted to this deponent that he did visit the cell of said Conley and offered him sandwiches and promised whiskey. And however he specifically disclaimed his being the party who had threatened said Conley at a later hour, and stated that the sandwiches and whiskey were offered in good faith with no intention to harm Conley, that the identity of this party is known to deponent and can be given the court upon request. And again, Conley repeats charges. Conley, in his affidavit, declared that during his stay in the county jail, he was constantly being menaced by persons whom he suspected of the intention to poison him. Quote, deponent was visited by a young man at one time who appeared to be of Jewish descent, who offered this deponent sandwiches to eat. That deponent did not eat the sandwiches for fear of being poisoned. That late in the night, after the lights had been turned out, a man came to the cell of deponent and struck a match and looked in and asked deponent if he did not know he would be hanged. told Deponent that he was telling a damned lie on Frank and would be hanged as sure as hell. Asked Deponent if he did not know he could shoot him in his cell, if he had a mind to do so. That on account of the darkness, Deponent was unable to find out who this was. That the only desire of Deponent is that he be given protection and be in the hands of sworn officers of the law and not turned over to any prisoner or to, quote, trusty turnkeys. So this is the kind of garbage that has to be endured by the innocent in the protection of this guilty Jew. A private agent hired by Frank had locked Conley in a 6x8-foot sweat box in the police station, like little more than a toilet stall, with a newspaper reporter stationed in the hallway recording the illegal interrogation. Dorsey said the agent and police detectives bored him and subjected him to a strenuous third degree. And Golden says the grilling included, quote, beating him. And just as Southern newspapers would pre-announce the time and place of an illegal lynching, an Atlanta Constitution headline announced in advance that, quote, Negro will be subjected to another third degree today. Leo Frank escaped these harsh interrogation methods, even though the whites that had him in custody believed him guilty of the rape and murder of Mary Fagan. In fact, at the trial he later claimed was unfair to him, Leo Frank did not even have to suffer cross-examination or any uncomfortable questioning at all. Blacks were subjected to yet another layer of abuse and intimidation, a psychological assault, when they were referred to in open court by Frank's lawyers as, quote, colored or, quote, nigger or darky, and the newspapers followed suit. No such bigoted, anti-ethnic, racist language was ever applied to Jews, in or out of court. Still, outside the jailhouse, violence befell blacks who had tendered evidence of Frank's guilt. In a mysterious attack, Frank's cook, Manola McKnight, was knifed across her face and was left with a 5-inch wound. She would not reveal her assailant if she knew, but the attack was suspected of being related to her damaging testimony in the Leo Frank case. Her husband, Albert, was in Frank's home on the afternoon of the murder and provided an account of Frank's movements that conflicted with Frank's alibi. McKnight sustained serious internal injuries, a gash to his head, and bruises in an incident on the train tracks involving him and the Atlanta police detectives. A circumstance for which we have only the police account. Albert McKnight had been previously threatened with bodily harm. A detective working for Leo Frank had promised Albert his help in finding a job as a Pullman porter if he would renounce his previous unfavorable testimony. If he refused, quote, the Jews would get him, unquote. Albert then repudiated his repudiation and claimed his original statement that damaged Frank's alibi was the truth. In doing so, he voluntarily asked to be placed in the protective custody of the police. Exclamation point. That's how afraid they were of the Jews seeking vengeance on them. Leo Frank himself commented on the incident, quote, is it not passing strange that a Negro of his own volition desire to be locked up in the station house? I venture the assertion that in the annals of police history, no Negro has ever made such a demand. Is it not remarkable that a Negro should try to break into jail? That's a good example of chutzpah from the guilty Jew. This action by McKnight is more of a commentary on the level of threats, intimidation, and violence by Frank's small army of mercenaries and operatives, a veritable lynch mob that on Leo Frank's behalf actually scared black people into jail. At the time of Leo Frank's trial, that kind of violence accompanied every aspect of black life in America. The mistreatment of blacks connected by circumstance to the fate of Leo Frank is especially disturbing both in its occurrence and in its disregard by scholars of the case. So you just ignore all the mistreatment to blacks. And well verified by the Nation of Islam. But that will conclude our session for today. And we see more rattiness on the part of the Jews. And we see the effects on everyone among them, and just lying, doing all manner of illegal activity to protect one of their own, guilty of illegal activity, which is known to them, which fact is known. The fact that he's a Jew outweighs everything else. That's really the main takeaway out of all this. The Jews, you are nothing but shit on their shoe to them. You have no value. They owe you nothing. They owe the court nothing. They will tell any lie. They will use any Gentile for any kind of sexual or commercial purpose and then discard them. And if they get caught, they'll all defend their own. They're thick as the thieves they are. Thanks for listening today, and I'll be back with you again real soon, and we'll pick up with some more in the Leo Frank case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man.